I'm Jackie Vetrano from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And I'm Logan Bishop from Belmont University. You're listening to Higher Ed Social, part of the Connect EDU network.
Well, with the power of Twitter and Liz Gross, we have another great guest. I'm so excited. So shout out to Liz and the power of Twitter. So why don't you, I guess we'll just kick it off. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Great. Yeah, I think it's pretty incredible how a platform like Twitter makes the world as accessible as it is and brings people like Liz and I and you and I together. So I'm excited to be on this podcast tonight and to guest kick things off. My name is Thea Zunick, although if you want to be all official and whatnot, you can go Dr. Thea Zunick. And I currently serve as the Director of Student Life at the University of Sciences in Philadelphia. I also do a lot of other things on the side, side hustle, side gig, just testing out the waters in different areas. I adjunct at Montclair State University in Montclair, New Jersey in their higher ed program. And I also adjunct at University of the Sciences teaching leadership to the students there. I volunteer for various organizations. I love my volunteer roles, specifically with NASPA, AFA, other organizations. I volunteer for various fraternal organizations and sororities as well, because I grew up in the Greek life sector, and spend free time writing, reading, researching, doing all those nerdy things.
Wow, you do all the things.
Yep. I try to do all the things. I feel like there's always something I'm not doing.
That's fair.
How does that make you feel?
We're all not doing.
It makes me feel awesome. I think my favorite question that I got from people when I finished my doctorate last year is, what do you do with all that free time? I'm like, free time? What's that?
Yep.
I filled that time that I used to spend reading and writing and revising, doing other volunteer things. I couldn't wait to get back into all that. It kind of feeds my soul, and spending time doing things that support higher education, no matter what the realm is something that really drives me and fuels me.
What are you adjunct teaching? Is it in this world of higher ed or is something totally different?
Yeah. At Montclair, I adjunct with the higher ed program in their School of Education. Probably the favorite class that I've taught so far is theory. And I never in a million years thought I would say that.
I don't think I ever liked theory. Yeah, go elaborate on that.
Okay, if you were in my theory class, I guarantee you, like 100% money back guarantee, that you would have some fun.
It sounds like it'd be really fun, but I mean, I guess you have to make it really fun, like really fun, for that material to be fun.
You know, it was my goal for the class to find theory accessible and relatable. So we dug deep into a lot of topics, and I personalized the class for the people who are in my class. So I could kind of read them and see what was piquing their interest, and I diversified how we learned in the class. Sometimes I had them teach, sometimes I taught, sometimes we watched silly videos and analyzed it through the lens of different theorists. Sometimes we did reflective activities, sometimes we did things that I would dream up of and see if it worked. And I was always getting feedback from them, and we really kind of grew to a point where we were both learning from each other, and I think that's what worked at the end.
That's great. Did you have then very, very small classes?
That class was about 18 students. So it was a good size for us to really kind of get into one another. And by the end of the semester, they talked about everything, every aspect of their identity, their development, their growth. It was a place where we developed a safe spot for people to just explore who they were and ask questions and be curious.
Yeah.
It was really, really neat.
That sounds like a great environment.
I happen to have gotten really lucky with the students I had. I have to say that.
Yeah, you definitely have to have the right people for that kind of material, for sure.
Right.
Absolutely.
I will say I had to just take a theory-based course, different theories, but theory-based, and it was not fun, mostly because it was online. And
that's tough.
It's really challenging.
Well, the tough part about that is, I mean, you just really have to, you have to learn it on your own as opposed to working with, you know, the people in your cohort to, you know, understand, right? And you can't ask questions. Like, typing questions is a whole lot different than actually talking. And even if you're on a phone call or something like that, a conference call, I mean, you guys accidentally speak over each other and all those kinds of things. I imagine, are your online classes, do you, when you're on the voice conference, because I know you guys do calls and stuff, is everybody on mute when they're talking or when the professor's talking?
Well, we actually, it's not like a virtual lecture like a lot of people would assume. Mm-hmm. I have calls 3 times a semester. One is like, welcome to my class. The second is, hey, it's the midpoint. And the third is, your final is due in a couple weeks. But other than that, it is exclusively learning on your own. So those calls, we're not learning, we're just talking. Oh. And just kind of like checking in. So the only like group work you ever do is pretty much through like Google Docs. If you really want to schedule like a Google Hangout or a Zoom call, you can. But most times the project doesn't really require that much collaboration. It's more like, we just need to get this paper done, which is really unfortunate because it's just like checking the box.
I think for online classes, there's various formats that you can engage in learning. Some of it is very self-directed, like what you're talking about. You could also have live chats. I taught an online class over the winter, and I did a blend of independent work and also collaborative work. And at one point, I even broke the class up into groups. And I said, you need to engage live discussion at this time during this week, so that way you could actually provide each other with immediate feedback on your discussion. Mm-hmm. And we started the class off with a virtual class where I was on, they can see me in real life. I introduced myself, I talked about my career trajectory and why I was teaching this class and what we could expect to learn. And then I went down the roster and had every student introduce themselves and talk a little bit about who they were. So that way the students knew who they were in class with, so they were more likely to reach out.
Yeah, that we have that introductory period. I think it's just, I don't know, for me personally, like, I don't feel like these people, I hate to say it, but they kind of feel just like they're not real. Like, they're just kind of also people that are floating. Like, I don't really know all that much about them. I know like their careers, but I don't know their personalities. And I mean, we talk a lot about like how to like better collaborate with people. And it really comes down to like being able to like chat. And I unfortunately don't have the opportunity to be like sitting in class and, you know, nudging the person next to me and being like, wait, what did she just say? Or even like, honestly, the shared misery sometimes of like how hard a class is or like how ridiculous an assignment is, really creates like a camaraderie that doesn't exist in an online classroom because you're just chugging through and chugging through and chugging through. I will say I got the chance to respond to a discussion board using exclusively a slow clap GIF to someone who I knew could like handle it, because he and I had just been in the same, we were in 2 classes together in the fall and 2 classes together in the spring, and so I kind of got to feel his personality out a little bit, and I knew that he would like handle it and like laugh. But you know, I don't like, I that's not something I would do with everyone because I really don't know who they are, and it took 4 classes for me to even say like, I think I can use this gift for this person. Like,
it almost reminds me, Josie Alquist does a lot of her classes online, and she has Twitter components to her class. And I distinctly remember her instructing one of her classes to respond to one another only in emojis and GIFs.
Love that.
And I thought that was super fun. And I mean, I was there for it. I was following the handle and the hashtag for the class because I was thoroughly entertained watching this conversation unfold that way.
That is a really great challenge.
It is.
I really like that idea.
See, the power
maybe I'll just do that on my own.
Yeah.
No one will know I'm doing it. That'll make it really awkward. Like, hey, and my professors will give me all zeros. I'll be like, no, but I'm trying to build personality.
Well, I'll know what you're doing. And anyone who listens to this podcast may know what you're doing.
Love it.
Love so that's it. How you can test to see if people listen to this episode. Are they responding to you in emojis?
Exclusively in emojis. And right. Yes, I'm fine with that. Fine with that. Because I think that's where we're getting to anyway, right? Like, there's going to be a point in life where the English language is obsolete and we only speak in emoji.
I hope not.
We're getting back to the age of hieroglyphics. We're going backwards.
That is a good point. I never thought about that.
Yes. These are things that I think about.
I can't wait, though, for, like, people of the future to read messages that are on Tinder, and it's just, like, eggplant, eggplant, peach, peach. Like, what? Like, what are these? Is this a cooking app? What is this?
Yes, it's a cooking app.
I don't understand.
Oh, wow, we're talking about eggplants now.
Well, we do have a clean rating on iTunes, so I guess we can't go further.
Right.
Urban Dictionary, that one. Right. Well, I don't know how to transition from this. I'm a little lost. What's going on with you?
Yeah.
How do you transition from eggplants to something else?
Something kind of. Higher Ed Social is part of ConnectEDU, a podcast network bringing together brilliant minds in the higher ed space and breaking down silos. There you can find some great shows no matter where you work on campus, as well as resources for first-time and long-time podcasters. You can follow ConnectEDU on Twitter at ConnectEDUPod, and don't forget to use hashtag ConnectEDU to join the discussion. Learn more about the ConnectEDU network and the great shows that are part of it at their website, connectedu.network. Now, back to the show.
So, tell us about what you do. Like,
what do
obviously,
I do?
You're...
Well, you know, I teach people about eggplant emojis. Apparently, no, I'm just kidding. So director of student life, that can mean a million different things, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was wondering, because
it often does.
It does mean many things and is actually different positions at different universities. So
yeah, and that's something. Now that I'm in this director role, I'm no longer the entry level professional or kind of the person who the supervisory line stops with. And I've been talking to some colleagues of mine as to what their directorship looks like and what they oversee and who they work with. And it's so varied. There really isn't one template or one answer that when you ask that question, somebody answers with. And so at University of the Sciences, they recently restructured the Office of Student Life and Student Affairs to try to make it more collaborative and more efficient. And so as the Director of Student Life, I oversee three main areas. I oversee the traditional student life stuff, which includes student government, campus activities board, orientation, fraternity and sorority life, community service, diversity and social justice programming, leadership, and whatever falls into our lap at the moment, like finding a convocation speaker, something I'm working on. But then I also oversee our Office of Residence Life and all the functionalities that go with that, whether it's move in, move out, roommate stuff. We're opening a brand new residence hall in the spring, which I'm very excited about. Training, being on call, all of those aspects of residence life. Mm-hmm. And then I also oversee International Student Services, which is
That's
a brand
cool.
new thing. Yeah, it's a brand new thing to my portfolio. And I say every day, I'm so glad that my supervisee who works in that area knows all the ins and outs of J-9 and visas, because, gosh, that's a really complicated area.
It is.
So we have a team of 9 people who work in student life, and those are my people. It's a fascinating arrangement, I think, of student life, something that I haven't found yet at an institution.
So who do you report to? Just curious. Just looking up and down the chain here.
Yeah, So I report to the associate dean, and primarily in his role, he does conduct, judicial staff, Title IX, policy adherence, and then he also oversees a couple different areas, our disability services office, our conduct office, and our health wellness area.
Okay. And I assume there's a dean of students too?
We do have a dean of students who also serves as the vice president of student affairs.
Okay. Cool. That kind of gives us a structure.
Yeah, so it's kind of like typical small school stuff, but atypical as well.
Yeah, it's a little different. Because at Belmont, the areas that you oversee are actually split between different associate deans. So, like health and wellness is one associate dean. Residence life and new student programs is another associate dean. We have another that is over just leadership. And then our student activities and organizations reports directly to the dean of students. So it's a little bit different structure. Yours definitely, I can see why you guys did that, because all of those areas really collaborate a lot.
Absolutely. And in the end, when we were talking about how to build a cohesive unit, all areas support student success.
Right.
And that's what ties us together. Mm-hmm. And you end up overlapping. And so it's really helpful when we sit around the table during our staff meetings for everyone to be in the room, because we all know what we're doing to support students and help our students achieve success at the university.
Indeed.
Are your staff meetings like the longest ever because there's so many people reporting?
We try to keep them efficient. We do a blend of hot topics in higher ed. I like to start with some type of professional development. If it's not a super busy time for us, I'll have staff pick articles of interest or something that they think might help the rest of the staff learn more about their specific area. And we'll do usually, a 20-minute discussion on the article. Sometimes it goes a little bit longer. And then we do big things that are happening on campus, things that everybody should know about. And then we do a quick around the room with just really high level highlights of what they're working on at that moment. So we try to keep staff meetings to about an hour if we can.
Yeah, I was going to say the art of the efficient yet like helpful meeting is so challenging.
Oh, absolutely. And it's something that, as a new director, I'm figuring out. And I ask for feedback from my staff all the time. I was like, how did that go today? Did we like that? Too much? Not enough?
We good? We feeling this?
I think their favorite meeting was when I said, I'm canceling staff meeting because you are all super busy. And I think you could use that hour to work on whatever you're working on. And they're like, yes, that's the best meeting ever.
I want to go do more work.
Yeah. But sometimes that canceled meeting and that found hour is like gold.
That is true. I've had that found hour. I've experienced that. It's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so how long have you been in this position?
Not very long. I'm in my 7th month in the role.
Very, very short time.
Yeah. Yep, but also still learning the ropes, still figuring things out.
Yeah. What's one thing that I guess surprised you, or I don't want to say you weren't ready for, but something new or different that you experienced?
I think one thing that surprised me was when you end up having a vacancy on your staff, you assume a lot of the responsibilities of that role while still doing the job you were hired to do and still supervising staff and making sure that you're providing them with a supportive environment, that you're still developing them professionally, and that they still get enough time with you as their supervisor while you're doing that other job and your job. And yep. It made me think about, I'm like, oh gosh, when I just left my last role, what did I do to my boss?
That is a good point.
Yeah, I definitely know that feeling. Way. I'm going through the same thing right now.
Oh yeah. What's going on with you?
Oh, Our web designer left, so I'm doing a lot of I'm doing a lot more than I usually do. I still have another member on my team plus some students helping me, and of course my student volunteers. But it's definitely interesting. It's fun sometimes because you get to do things that you wouldn't normally do, but at the same time, everything still needs to get done. So,
absolutely.
Not something I typically would prefer to be doing, but you know, we get to do it, and that's always fun, I guess.
And I think the other thing, that as difficult as it is right now to juggle all of those things, it's going to make me a better supervisor. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, I will really understand what that person is doing day in and day out because I just did it.
Right. That's how I tend to think about it.
Right. So once you get over the overwhelmed, panicky stage of, oh my gosh, how I'm going to do this, you know, it's very motivating to know that you're going to be a better supervisor in the end. You're going to really understand how to best support that person, and you're going to be a better resource to that person as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that you'll be a better, like, assist when it comes to transitioning for a new person to come into the role. Will definitely help them understand the role, like what is expected, what are the tips and tricks, how do I do this,
right? Who do you talk to when this happens?
Yep.
Right. So I think it's something that is not in the manual when you're like, here's how to be a director of student life. Not written down, something that you wouldn't know until you step into that role and you start experiencing the nuances of being in that mid-level supervisor position that no one tells you, but it will happen to you at some point.
Mm-hmm. So are you going to write a book of all the tips and tricks on how to be a mid-level supervisor?
Of course. I'm just going to put that on my list of things to do.
Because we know you have a lot of free time.
I do. I'll find some to write this book, you know, or at least a blog or something.
There you go.
Or I'll probably do it how I usually love to, you know, share knowledge, is present at a conference. That's totally my jam. I presented with a grad school cohort member of mine from Florida. Ann Stark, she and I presented on being that mid-level professional and being in that position where you're supervising up and down, and how do you do that and how do you navigate that. So we've presented on that topic before, except here was my secret. I actually wasn't supervising full-time staff when we gave that presentation, but nobody knew.
But I mean, if you pulled it off, if you played it cool.
Oh yeah.
Who knows?
Fake it till you make it.
Yep. I'm so about that. So do you have any conferences on your agenda, either attending or presenting, that people should look out for?
Yeah. I'll probably, hopefully present at the big NASPA conference in LA.
Very cool.
I'm in the formation stage of chatting with some colleagues about what we might want to present. Thinking about maybe going to AFA, the Association of Fraternity Advisors, and then I'm sure things will pop up along the way. But yeah, I'm pretty much a standard NASPA goer. And then I'm actually the chair of the Careers and Student Affairs Conference for our region, NASPA 2 region. And we are going to host one of the locations at University of the Sciences. So I imagine I'll probably convince myself to do one or two presentations.
How fun.
Cool. Yeah.
So I feel like a lot of folks that are like on the conference circuit have their like go-to session that they like to present, or one that they were just like, oh, that was amazing, I did so good. Like, what is your your jam?
I usually like to present on things that I know a little bit about because it challenges me to learn a lot more about it. But I'll say that my recent presentations that were probably my favorite were presenting my dissertation research, because I finally got to share with other people what I found and what I thought, and it was really a capstone experience for that whole process for me. And then I recently did a presentation at the annual NASPA conference, And this is like an idea I've been working on for a while. And so I was excited to present it with a couple of fantastic colleagues. And it was about throwing out the idea of work-life balance. You know, we stress ourselves out so much trying to balance this, that, and the other thing, and comparing ourselves to other people and telling ourselves we're spending too much time here, staying too late at the office, should do this, shouldn't do that. And just really focus on filling your life with things that fulfill you. What makes you happy? Listen to yourself, reflect on what you're doing and what you're not doing. And if you're not happy doing something, do what you can to change or adjust it. And take out the mindset that you have to do something because somebody else is doing it. Or you shouldn't stay late at the office because you shouldn't stay late at the office. If you're working on a project and you're motivated and you're doing the work, stay late, get it done. See if you can come in late the next day. And if you're in an environment that you can't do that, then you just have to think about that in your career choices. And I gave everyone in the audience permission to just stop counting the hours and just do what makes them happy. And the look of relief on some people's faces was worth me standing in front of that room working on that presentation for hours. Because I kind of gave them permission to say, oh, I could just do what makes me happy. Cool. I got this. Because I said to them, I said, how many of you stress over the work-life balancing, and how many of you have ever achieved it? And they were all like, no. I'm like, that's why you're all here, right? Because you're looking for a different way, right? And they're like, yeah, definitely. I said, okay, great, stop doing it. Just be happy. I'm
smiling so much. This is so nice.
I think we all had a moment in that room, and everyone was like, yeah, okay, I got this. And I loved it. And I just lived in that moment. And I think I'm like getting goosebumps thinking about it legitimately right now, because it was kind of powerful to just give people permission just to be happy. Who am I to say that, you know, hey, they were listening.
Yeah. I know how that feeling is a great feeling.
Yeah.
Was this the centerpiece of your thesis then, or was it something different?
Totally different. Totally different. My dissertation, I have such a passion for fraternity and sorority, and my dissertation was evaluating the outcomes of men who are a part of the Sigma Phi Epsilon Residential Learning Community Program, and looking at, does it make a difference with their levels of social engagement, their engagement with campus, their academic performance, how they interact with faculty. I use the NESI as my survey instrument, and really found some fascinating things. I was able to recommend some things for SIGEP to work on to improve the program. We were able to highlight some really fascinating things, like the men in this program by far exceed academically when compared to the fraternities of SIGEP that don't have this program implemented. And I was able to compare men when they entered into college of similar high school GPAs, and that really helps strengthen the correlation to say that the men are entering into school with similar GPAs, and we compared like schools, and being engaged in the residential learning community demonstrated a higher GPA than the non-residential learning community chapters. And so just on that alone, it's a good thing. And they are really thinking outside the box in that fraternity, because, I mean, you put a group of men in a house together, and, you know, sometimes they may influence each other in not the best ways, depending if there's any structure or mentorship or leadership or programs or expectations. And, you know, no other fraternity is doing something like this as wide scale as they are. And so I was fascinated by the program, and I was also inspired by the SIGEP chapter that I was working with when I worked at Stevens Institute of Technology, because they had a very strong representation of that program, and they really followed the program to a T. And I was like, there's something here. There's something to look at here, and I think other fraternities and sororities as well should also be looking at this program. So I wanted to do some research to see if there was something there.
That's super interesting.
Yeah.
What made you pick SIGEP specifically? Or were they just one that you felt would work for the for this kind of test?
So SIGEP is the only fraternity that has a residential learning community program that has been implemented in a large chunk of chapters. There are other fraternities that are doing this, but it's more of a one-off program.
That makes sense.
So I had a bigger sample set to pull from, and I've been volunteering with SIGEP for, gosh, over 10 years, and so I have a good relationship with the fraternity. So I said, I'd love to research this, and they said, great, because that's actually something that we are increasing is research on our program. So that really fits in with our vision and our mission. So it was kind of like a match made in heaven there.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Wow. What a cool little like investigation. How long, did you kind of work on this? Would you call it a study? Like whatever you would call it, your dissertation, how long did it take you?
From, I guess, if you count the work that I did during my classes as far as doing research on the history of fraternity, talking to different people, looking at housing and where that all came from, it was over the course of a couple years. But the study itself probably took about a semester, and then I had to evaluate all the data and write it up and come to some conclusions and make suggestions for future research, write about my limitations and findings. So it was over a year long process. It felt like 20 years.
I was going to ask you like what sort of future implications, if any, or future studies, that you kind of, came to from this.
I think one of the things that I would love to do next is look deeper into the chapters that we know are doing this program correctly, that scored exceptionally high, and do some interviewing to find out what is contributing to that environment. Is it the institution? Does this program work better at different types of schools? Does this program work better when you have a faculty member who is really invested in the chapter? Because part of the component of this program is to have a faculty fellow and to work one-on-one with that faculty member, because as the young men interact with faculty more, they're more likely to talk about things about non-academic topics or have academic topic conversations and just become more comfortable talking to faculty in general. And then they become more likely to talk to other faculty when they need help and support in different classes, because they see faculty as real people. So what are the pieces of this program that are working the best? And that's something you could really glean from interviewing or perhaps some observational work and just sitting in a house and seeing how the men interact with each other and how it differs. And I could tell it when I spent time in the physical house of that chapter of SIGEP at Stevens. It has a different feeling to it. Part of it is the men take more pride in their space. They also originally had chosen to be a dry facility because they didn't want their social life and engagements interacting with their academic engagements. And so they said there's a time and a place for alcohol if you're 21, just not in the house.
So, interesting.
Yeah, and their house was immaculate at all times. And it just the pride that they took in their space and the way that they interacted with one another in that space was very different than many other facilities that I've been in. And so I do think that there's some good stuff going on there.
That counters like every stereotype I know about frat houses.
Right. And I would never, ever call that a frat house ever, because it's a fraternity home. Like, it's their home.
Yeah. Do you feel like this is kind of, I'm going to guess the answer is no. I assume this is not a one size fits all type of thing, right? Like this isn't going to work for every fraternity or sorority.
Absolutely not. But I do think that there might be components of this program that other groups could emulate.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I'm very excited to see future research and future papers and all these great things coming out of it.
Yeah.
That's so exciting. So, well, I think that's a great place to stop. I think that's all the time we have for this great chat. It's
yeah,
so
I could talk about higher ed and student affairs and my work and my research forever.
Well, we'll just have you on 1,000 more shows.
Happy to do it. I'll be here for it. I'll even do 1,001.
Yes. Well, listeners, we hope that you'll listen to all 1,000 of our future episodes. But thank you for listening today. If you want to see all the links to the cool stuff we talked about, head over to our website, highered.social. You can also check out some other great episodes and subscribe to the show, of course, either through the website or pretty much wherever you get podcasts. Also, if you want to send us a tweet, you can find us on Twitter at @HESpodcast. Feel free to let us know what you think about the show, or if you want to be on it, or if you just want to say hey, or send us a GIF or emoji. Definitely do that. The Higher Ed Social Podcast is produced by the amazing Emma Haas and is part of the Connect EDU Podcast Network, which is the first podcast network for higher education. You can learn more at connectedu.network or follow them on Twitter at @ConnectEDUPod. Thanks for listening and have a great week.